No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it. Hello. No, You Tell It is a series that switches up the storytelling. So each performer writes a true life tale and then, switching with a partner, performs the other person's story, giving everyone involved the chance to share their own stories and experience someone else's. Some Know You Tell It stories are straightforward narratives. Others, like Alex Gray's monograph series, use different works of art as a means of sparking a conversation. Fred Backus kicked off our Urban Dwellers show by reading this meditation on love and loss and life in New York City. Here's Fred Backus reading Monograph Series, written by Alexander Gray.
Monograph. Now, a treatise on a particular subject as a biographical study or study of the works of one artist. Museum of Modern Art, New York City, number 16. Red, brown, and black, Mark Rothko. I turn a corner and the painting is suddenly in front of me. Giant, heavy, unmovable. Three dark rectangles stare down, momentarily overwhelming my senses. I look down at the floor, then up. I breathe in. I am here. My feet are on the floor. I breathe out. In old movies, when someone loses their job, they always go to Central Park, probably because they don't know where else to go. They've lost their routine, their rhythm. This is my routine. If I am in any city with a painting by Mark Rothko, I go and visit it, like an old friend. It's not so much about the artist himself. Rothko is long dead, and I don't feel a huge kinship with him as a person. But his paintings vibrate off the canvas, jump forward at me, tell stories, state facts with their mute and determined lack of figure. If anything, it's these inanimate objects I feel a kinship with, though to me the term inanimate doesn't apply at all. Each work has a life, a beating heart. I am drawn like a magnet and would stand in front of his paintings all day if I could. And now I have all day. Oh. Good. No reason to be anywhere at 9 a.m. or 10 or even noon. Days, then weeks line up in front of me, all empty, like legions of inflatable question marks cascading into the sky, which is infinite. I focus on practical things, like feeding myself. An inventory of my apartment reveals that I have lots of rice, old rice in jars. If I lived in Little House on the Prairie, it would be infested by weevils by now. But thanks to the miracle of modern food storage, it's still edible. I make a note to make lots of rice dishes. But I am not much of a cook. In the few days since my dismissal, I have subsisted on the kinds of dishes that appear in children's cookbooks. Foods that require assembly only, as opposed to the dangerous use of flame or heat. I'm eating starter foods, as I myself am starting over. The only difference between me now and me at 6 years old is that the banana slices on my toast are no longer arranged in a smiley face. If they were arranged to express my state of mind, the eye slices would be bruised to illustrate lack of sleep. The mouth would be cut slim as lips pressed hard together by anxiety. There would be eyebrows, probably made out of rice, raised upward to indicate indecision or fear. There is a stress scale developed by Thomas Holmes and Richard Ray, two prominent psychiatrists, to measure the impact of various life events on a person's psychological well-being. According to the scale, the sudden loss of a job is comparable to a grievous bodily injury. I stand in the gallery and wonder if this is what phantom limb syndrome feels like. Tate Modern, London, Seagram's Mural Series. At some point, I will stop being surprised at the emotional weight of these visits, but not yet. It's 1999, and visiting London is still like visiting the past, my own and my mother's. This is her home. The city where she was born, spent most of the war, and grew into the woman who married my father and moved to the States. London is simultaneously familiar. I feel more at home here than in some of the places I've actually lived, and strange, like it doesn't belong to me. At the Tate, I beeline to the Rothko Gallery. When I sit down on the bench in the center of the room, I begin to cry. The paintings are vast, unfathomable, and I am dwarfed in comparison. They're from Rothko's later career. His pictures got darker and darker, and then he cut his wrists. I breathe in, then out. This Christmas is the first I have ever spent in London. I feel so grateful for the welcoming embrace of my cousins, who share a great deal of history with me, despite growing up on different continents. There's also the shared vernacular of English Christmas: pudding, sherry, crackers, paper hats, and day drinking. But there's also a deeper vocabulary that I don't share, locked just beneath the surface, that only my uncle, aunt, and cousins speak. They are a family. They spend every Christmas together. I'm just a relation. I'm probably being melodramatic. They are so loving and generous. They know why I'm here. Maybe I want to feel like an outsider. Maybe I don't want to be a part of the family without my mother. Standing in front of the paintings, I feel none of that. I am completely at home and completely absorbed. On Christmas Day, I pad downstairs in the official uniform of English Christmas: bird's nest hair and pajamas. My cousin Claire follows, outdoing me with a set of plush reindeer antlers on a headband. Alfie, only a year and a half old, is already playing with a toy Hoover. Gleefully, he shoves the hose attachment in his mouth and hums until he laughs. Torn wrapping paper soon makes a shambles of the carefully decorated living room, and every gift is exclaimed over, including the ones I brought. We break out the chocolates and sherry, and I am put to work in the kitchen on the long slog towards Christmas dinner. Once it's over, we're laying about like sedated walruses, and my uncle suggests a game. We consume a bit more sherry while guessing the names of celebrities based on a series of verbal clues. I feel useless, unable to recognize the names of footballers and stars of UK reality television. I manage to stump everyone with a few American celebrities, but that's not the point of the game. It's about drawing connections, finding common ground. Clearly, I'm still somewhere else. Houston, Texas, Rothko Chapel. The cab driver drops me off and I feel a momentary thrill. I made it. It's so cold and quiet here, away from the center of the city. It's 2008. I'm in Houston for a conference, which is fine. Today I escape from the pacifying blandness of the hotel, skipping the morning session to come here. I look around. The neighborhood is residential, a riot of crisp orange leaves. I turn, walk to the chapel, open the door. It is even colder and quieter inside, and it is everything I hoped it would be. The walls are gray concrete, and I'm surrounded by Rothko's paintings. These ones contain no distinct boxes of color. They're smooth, monochromatic, colossal. A glass panel overhead provides the only light. I sit on a bench. It's heavy, dark wood that feels well-worn under my palms. My eyes glide over every surface in the chapel, consuming the quiet, the cool air. I breathe in, then out. I can't believe I'm in Texas. The Rothko Chapel is understated, quiet, humble, everything Texas is not. I had to take a cab here because, surprise, Houston is not a walking city. I walk anyway and come across some gorgeous old neon signs and theater marquees, all of them on buildings that are boarded up. I take a few pictures knowing they won't be here for long. The photos create a parallel narrative to the frantic whirlwind of the conference. Instead of four exhausting days spent taking notes and introducing myself, I remember bold red neon letters splashed above curved glass, a pop art sculpture rising from thick green grass, my own face reflected in the cracked mirror of a mosaic. They remind me that the job where I spend 45 hours a week, the one that threatens to crush my creative life under its wheels, isn't what defines me. The camera, a stand-in for the lenses and shutters of my own eyes, creates the space where I exist and the possibility of escape. I lose track of how long I've been sitting in the chapel. Only one other visitor comes in while I'm there, and she leaves before I do. I get up slowly, take a last look around. No pictures allowed. There's a little pool outside the chapel, and I stare into its glassy waters for a while until I start to feel self-conscious. I pull the driver's card out of my pocket and call the number. Museum of Modern Art, New York City, number 3/13. Magenta, black, green on orange. This painting hangs right next to number 16, the dark one I was gazing at just a few days ago. Still no job. But number 3/13 is an undeniably joyful work, a bright and gushy juxtaposition to the dark vortex next door. It was created in the prime of Rothko's career, shortly after he perfected the color block format that became his signature. Rothko was born in what used to be Latvia, now part of Russia. But upon arriving in the States, he assimilated completely and became strongly identified with New York. I am a city girl like my mother. Even though I began life in the Berkeley Hills of California and spent my childhood in various suburbs, which for the most part were indistinguishable from one another, when people ask, "Where are you from?" I feel compelled to give a hurried compound answer. California, the Northwest, Pennsylvania, then New York. I have lived in New York City nearly 20 years. My roots go deeper, stretch further, but I only have a tentative grip on the first few places in my origin story. The roots that anchor me in New York are newer but much stronger, grown hard with calluses and a bit of scar tissue. If I want, I can give the short answer. I'm a New Yorker. This is home. I take the city for granted, as with anything familiar. I become enraged at the same cliched laundry list of gripes that make every New Yorker occasionally contemplate escape. The expense, noise, traffic, crowds, crime, corruption, and good God, what is that smell? Is that shit? Human shit? But since losing my job, New York has taken care of me in a way that I didn't know I needed until suddenly I did. I wandered into Central Park a few days ago and ended up in front of the Bethesda Fountain, staring at the lilies in the pool. It's familiar. I've seen it at night with its angel wings silhouetted against the sky. I've made wishes there on my birthday. I visit the fountain, like Rothko's paintings, because I belong to them, just as I like to think they belong to me. On September 11th, I was in London visiting my family. In fact, I was sitting next to my cousin Claire as we watched the towers turn to rubble on TV. The buildings, the city were falling apart, and all I wanted to do was be there. When I finally arrived a few days later after a surreal flight where I'm pretty sure everyone was drunk, I was approached by a complete stranger. She must have seen my eyes as I stumbled to the cab stand with my bags. She reached for my hand and said very deliberately, "Welcome home." I'm on the fourth floor of the MoMA, my eyes tracing explosions of orange and magenta in number 3/13. People are swarming around me, but I don't move. I am trying to absorb the joy, the optimism in these colors. I take in the space, the quiet, until it's not outside of me anymore. I feel the gallery floor under my feet. I breathe in and out.
In a story that could only take place in the East Village of a certain era, Fred Backus tells us about leaving his punk rock youth behind. If you've never heard of G.G. Allin, be prepared. This story is not meant for delicate ears. Switching it up, here's Alexander Gray reading G.G. Allin Says Goodbye, written by Fred Backus.
We were standing outside, not sure if we wanted to attend. I was more reluctant than Mark. It was $7. That was kind of a lot of money for a show back then. Then Gigi strode past us, followed by his entourage, wearing nothing but combat boots, a leather jockstrap, a jean jacket, and a Nazi helmet. Our decision was made. We were going in. G.G. Allin and the Murder Junkies were in town. G.G. Allin, Manchester, New Hampshire's greatest contribution to rock and roll. In the late 70s, he was doing catchy pop-punk ditties until something seemed to snap inside him in the 80s, and his vocal range dropped an octave, turning what was once a snotty whine into a guttural growl. His subject matter changed as well. What first came off as teenage rebellion had now transformed into a seething embodiment of violence, degradation, and depravity. Take, for example, the lyrics to a song called Teenage Twats. Hey, little girl, you squeak when you walk. I want to tie you up and shit on your face. Die when you die. Die when you die, when you die, when you die. If you get AIDS, spread it around and take some lives. You get the idea. But the G.G. Allin songbook paled in comparison to the G.G. Allin stage act. He was known for performing naked on stage. Rumor had it that he took laxatives before shows to ensure that he had an ample supply of fecal matter to fling at the audience. The stories were legendary. That he once shat on a biscuit and ate it. That he once sucked his own brother's dick on stage. In between moments of self-degradation, he would assault people. He once grabbed a woman by the hair and dragged her between his legs and took a crap on her head. He threw punches, beat people up, and often got beat up in return. He didn't care. Sid Vicious may have been punk's most notorious nihilist, but G.G. Allin was its purest. He announced he would commit suicide on stage on October 31st, 1990, and it was generally assumed that he would take everyone in attendance out with him. He didn't make the date because he was in prison for tying up his girlfriend and lighting her hair on fire. He was out of jail now and playing New York. It was 1993, and we were standing outside a spot called the Gas Station on the corner of Avenue B and 2nd Street. It was, in fact, an abandoned gas station, but it wasn't the sort of refurbished theme venue you might expect to find these days. Instead, it had pretty much been left to decay as is until some local artists transformed it, surrounding it and filling it with sculptures made from welded metal and other discarded debris. One of many such sculpture gardens dotting the vacant lots and reclaimed gardens of the Lower East Side. Space and reclaimed material were plentiful back then if you were willing to recycle what others had thrown away. Sculptures in the neighborhood made good use of both and created some astonishing works of art. The Junk Tower on 6th Street rose a couple of stories high, a towering beacon of trash turned into art, calling attention to what the city had given up on and later telling the bulldozers where to show up when it was time to take it all back. The gas station was both a physical product and a symbol of the neighborhood at that time. It's hard to imagine a time when real estate in the city wasn't in a constant state of redevelopment. But back in the late 80s, which was around the time I discovered there was a neighborhood in Manhattan where the avenues ran out of numbers, the city seemed positively primeval compared to the way it is now. I've been coming downtown since I was about 14 or so, drawn there from the relative safety of Westchester. The Central and East Village became the pilgrimage destination for kids who were into certain types of music throughout the tri-state region and beyond. My poison was punk rock. And in Dobbs Ferry, there were two of us, just Mark and me. And as we got older, we found ourselves being drawn east to the abandoned lots and buildings where the scene was a little wilder and more authentic. Eventually, we ended up in a band together called The Casualties, and I soon found myself inside the wild and chaotic punk scene of the Lower East Side. We had played the gas station a year or so before the G.G. Allin show. A lot of our shows were places like that, abandoned warehouses and squats. My first official gig with the Casualties was at a squat called Lucky 13, and we found out about the show because the squatters who lived there put up flyers around the neighborhood with our band in the lineup, hoping we'd show up. The neighborhood was filled with squats back then, which mostly orbited Tompkins Square Park like planets around a dying star. The block where Lucky 13 was situated, 13th Street between A and B, must have had at least half a dozen squats on that stretch alone. I always felt like the squats were in some ways the heart and soul of the neighborhood. A neighborhood that was dangerous, dirty, and infested with junkies, yet it was also infested with life. Punks, artists, writers, drag queens, a swirling sea of the creative anarchic forces that was still the Lower East Side. But it couldn't last. By the time G.G. Allin played the gas station in 1993, the writing was on the wall. A series of violent confrontations with the forces of gentrification had been taking place for a few years around Tompkins Square Park since the 1988 riot. The last big uprising of resistance would be in 1995 when the 13th Street squats were cleared by the NYPD in riot gear. It was the neighborhood's last stand. The squatter, Little Big Horn. The squats are all gone now, as are all pretty much all of the denizens and watering holes of the Lower East Side. It's strange to find yourself missing a city you never left, walking around it in circles year by year and watching it slip away a little more with every step to the concrete. I found myself on the Lower East Side on a Sunday not too long ago, trying to remember where everything was. There are no vacant lots or abandoned buildings. Spots like downtown Beirut or the Lismar Lounge have been replaced by restaurants where you can spend $20 on a two-egg omelet, or bars that are filled with meatheads and football jerseys watching big screen TVs. There's a Duane Reade on the corner of 2nd Street and Avenue B where the gas station once stood. And it too, like the gas station before it, now stands as a symbol of the neighborhood. I don't know what happened to all the scrap art sculptures that used to adorn the gas station, and I wasn't spending much time thinking about them back in 1993 as I went in to see Gigi Allen. I didn't think about them much until they were gone. Instead, I was thinking about getting a broken nose or getting covered in shit. I was ambivalent about being there. I suppose it was an event that was not to be missed, but a hard one to justify. It felt somehow morally irresponsible, like eagerly watching a car wreck, and that's only if you're lucky enough not to end up as roadkill yourself. Truth be told, I wasn't even really a part of this scene anymore. I was out of the band and in college and in Connecticut by this time, just back for the summer, 1 foot in, 1 foot out. My aspirations were elsewhere, as were many of my friends. Our pals, the Denied, were the opening act, which was one reason I was there. I guess I saw them play. I don't remember. Gigi Allen and the Murder Junkies wiped away any memory of their set. I do remember when the Murder Junkies started to play, it was loud. And in no time, Gigi Allen was out there in nothing but combat boots and a dog collar. Once he got naked, it was hard not to notice that he had an impossibly small dick. A dick so small that you could not even see that he had one at first. Whether this explained anything about his psyche, I didn't have time to ponder. Because things started to get going, and I can't remember whether it was his fists or his shit started flying first. I think it was his fists. I remember he savagely punched a guy in the face almost immediately, still clutching the microphone after growling out the first verse of the song. Then dirty brown liquid started exploding from his ass, a clumpy, soupy mixture that he smeared all over his body. He wailed on a few people who got too close, punching them in the face. I guess some people in the front row really didn't expect him to live up to the hype. Most just staggered away, dazed from the blows. Those who decided to fight back were quickly taken out by the bouncers, who, sadly, were friends of ours, intoxicated by the violence and their momentary positions of power. It was bullshit. Frankly, if you're going to open up the floodgates of violence, you shouldn't just be able to dish it out without it coming back to you. It was hard to feel bad for the wounded, however. Like the running of the bulls, we all fully deserved whatever was coming to us just by being there. It's not as if we hadn't been warned. That's why I didn't feel terribly sorry for the giggling girl who was taking photos up front. I don't think she comprehended exactly what we were dealing with here. Gigi took a clump of shit in one hand, pulled her camera down with his other hand, and shoved the clump into her face. She was still giggling. I guess she didn't know. By this point, he was flinging clumps of feces into the audience indiscriminately, like a crazed gorilla at the zoo, at the people who, like me, had hoped against hope that they could see this business out without getting down dirty with Gigi. He began to charge the audience, and it's a pretty remarkable thing to see 100 or so people running in actual fear from one solitary naked man. There were a few people who he didn't fuck with, however. Some of the squatter punks, the real deals, not guys like me who had 1 foot in and 1 foot out, the guys who were singing along to the songs right up front and center, for whom Gigi Allen wasn't just a freak or a novelty or an anecdote, but for whom Gigi Allen actually meant something. For all the things he could be revived for, Gigi Allen was perhaps as true an expression of counterculture and nonconformity as you could conceive of, living fully in the moment without regard to the future, searching for that moment where the primal forces of creation and destruction meet. As for me, I was headed in a different direction. Was I a poser? Well, in context perhaps I was, but the bar was set pretty high. Maybe it was the realization, or the bleeding people around me, or the shower of fecal matter that splattered Mark's arm, that convinced me it was time to go. I was not punk rock enough for Gigi Allen. I decided I was okay with that. I'd lasted 7 minutes, $1 a minute, but I reckon. The show didn't last much longer. It was still daylight. And there were plenty of people who fled before me, mingling on the street. More were to follow. They came in waves. You'd hear screams from inside the garage, and then through the gaps in the scrap metal, you'd see the audience run in terror into the yard. Slowly, they'd creep back in, but never dwindling numbers. I'm not sure how many rounds Mark lasted, but I'm pretty sure he was outside when, after one particularly loud and prolonged bash of crashing and screaming, the bouncers carried someone out, unconscious but twitching, and dropped him in the gutter on 2nd Street. After that point, most of the audience had fled for good, and there were just a handful of the furiest and filthiest inside. The band was no longer playing. Someone had cut the power. Finally, Gigi himself appeared, striding out into Avenue B, wearing nothing but his biker boots and his own feces. A motley assortment of his most faithful marching behind him, chanting, Gigi, Gigi, directly towards the panicked passengers of a city bus heading south on Avenue B. Gigi threw himself in the street in front of the bus, after which his followers unleashed a barrage of glass bottles as it helplessly tried to get away amidst the blaring sirens of the soon-to-be-arriving police force. When they started throwing bottles at the cops, things started to get ugly, though Gigi was no longer on the scene by then. I remember one night, years ago, drinking 40s outside of Mona's on Avenue B, when a guy we called Limey Sean told me his philosophy of punk. When someone tells you not to smash a bottle against a car, you smash it against your own face. It's not a philosophy for living to a ripe old age. It's the here and now, relentless and unforgiving. By its nature, it can't last. For Gigi Allen, this would be his final blaze of glory, his little big horn. He overdosed on heroin later that night. His appearance at the gas station marked not just his last show, but his ultimate act on Earth, a bowl burning brightly before it burned itself out, leaving blood, shit, and broken glass in his wake. Looking back, I suppose it signaled the beginning of the end of an era for me, for the neighborhood, and certainly for Gigi Allen. An unrepentant explosion of spirit, a pus-filled boil spraying out the creativity, the filth, the danger, and the beautiful ugliness that still was, but would not be much longer. Soon to be paved away like everything else, along with the blood, shit, and broken glass.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of Know You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.